Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for February 8th, 2018, the correction, not a crash edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I'm in Washington, D.C. Joining me together, a matched pair from the CBS studio in Manhattan, John Dickerson of CBS's This Morning. Howdy, John.
Hello, David. We're in the CBS studio thanks to the great work, and for which we're grateful, of Dustin Gervais.
Thank you, Dustin. And Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine at John's side. Hello, Emily.
Hello, hello. I have no one to thank.
On this week's Gabfest, the president's lawyers are setting him up to refuse an interview with special counsel Robert Mueller, even as the Nunes memo fallout continues. We'll talk about the latest twists and turns in the Russia investigation. Then stocks were down, then back up. Why is the stock market, which has been so boring, suddenly so interesting? Then the very disturbing Rob Porter domestic abuse scandal that's transfixing White House world. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. And we have a live show coming up. Well, we have a couple of live shows coming up. Our Portland show, as we mentioned last week, is sold out. That's okay. We are going to be in St. Louis. Well, it's not okay if you live in Portland. But we're going to be in St. Louis, Missouri, and St. Louis, Missouri, both of those cities, on May 2nd at the Sheldon Concert Hall. You can get tickets at slate.com/live. Learn more about that show. Tickets are going quickly, so go there fast. It's our first show in Missouri, St. Louis, Sheldon Concert Hall on May 2nd, slate.com/live for tickets. There is lots to talk about re-Russia. We can start with the Trump and Mueller tete-a-tete. The New York Times reported this week that the president's lead lawyer, John Dowd, is urging President Trump not to submit to a sit-down interview with special counsel Robert Mueller about Russia. The president has said that he wants to talk on the record to Mueller because, of course, he did nothing wrong. There's no obstruction or collusion. So, he's glad to talk about it. But as the Times nicely put it, Trump's history of lying has his lawyers fretful that he could be charged with lying to the investigators. And there seems to be some talk about limiting Mueller to written questions or perhaps to no questions at all. Meanwhile, there is continuing fallout from the Nunes memo, which came out last week after we taped the show and was a little bit of a dud. Well, John, was the memo a dud?
Well, I think, and David correctly pronounced Nunes, which many of us might have said Nunes, and you may have heard that, but apparently, according to the good congressman himself, that's the way you pronounce it. Just on the narrow question of the memo, I think that there are two ways to look at it. One is, I think, the bigger thing, which is that it had been built up by both its supporters, the president among them, the supporters of releasing the Republican memo, and to some extent, the Democrats, though people may disagree with me, which is they said this was going to destroy sources and methods and undermine the FBI. And then when you read the memo, I didn't feel like there was that much destruction going on. I felt like the memo talks about some potentially, and I say potentially because we only have a portion of the story because the full FISA application was not released. And so we have a partisan picture of this FISA application. But if it was true that the FISA application was based on information that wasn't kind of that the judges weren't given the full picture of where the information came from, that should be discussed, and it wouldn't be good if they were essentially hoodwinked. But the more it seemed to me problematic and deeply problematic issue with the memo was that it was claimed by the president to exonerate him on the entire investigation, and it didn't do that at all. And the person who offered the best analysis of that was Trey Gowdy, who helped Nunes produce the memo.
And the only person who's read all the underlying intelligence material.
That's exactly right. And I thought, so in the two reasons I felt like it severely undermined that claim is A, because in the Nunes memo, it says that George Papadopoulos and his conversation with the Australian ambassador was what kicked off the collusion investigation. So there was within the memo proof that the Steele dossier had nothing to do with the start of the investigation into the collusion question. That was number one. And then the facts we learned about the Steele dossier and the investigation of Carter Page, which was the central issue of the memo, which is essentially that this partisan, according to the Republicans, that this partisan information from Steele was used to get a FISA warrant of Carter Page. But the again, I go back to the narrative here. The narrative that the FBI, deep state at the highest levels, was engaged in a conspiracy to keep Donald Trump from being elected makes no sense if you look at the Nunes memo. In the Nunes memo, it shows this application was made to the judges 17 days before the election. If you were a deep state anxious to keep Donald Trump from being elected, this is an awfully big bank shot to come up with information that presumably would be so damning that you'd one day release it and that somehow would get voters to vote against Donald Trump.
And you kept it all a secret before the election, too.
The more plausible explanation, if you were a deep stater who really wanted to undo the president, would be to take the information you'd had for months and months beforehand, starting in June of 2016. And that was related to both Papadopoulos and his meeting where he talked about Russian dirt with the Australian ambassador, but also they'd been investigating Manafort that summer. So if you were a deep stater, why would you take the grade A material, which presumably if you let it out would hurt Donald Trump, and instead wait till 17 days before the election and file this and do this incredibly circuitous thing that might pay off or not pay off? It just doesn't make any sense at all.
You're so naive, John.
And then finally, I would say that
all that
grade A stuff about Papadopoulos and Manafort never leaked. It never leaked before the election. And guess who was in charge of the Papadopoulos investigation? Who initiated it? Agent Strzok, the person who the memo says was so hell-bent on protecting Hillary Clinton and hurting Donald Trump and was a known leaker. So this guy in June knows about Papadopoulos and never leaks it, even though, as the Republicans have characterized him, he is obsessed with keeping Donald Trump from the presidency. So it just didn't fit in any possible way with all of these theories. And therefore, I felt like it was not a document that helped the case of those who've been trying to argue for a deep state effort.
So, Emily,
I just wanted to make one point about this question of burning sources. My understanding of the argument against releasing the memo, and maybe I'm just turning into my idealized argument, but the thing that makes sense to me is that you can't judge the memo on its own without knowing more about the underlying background. And so that's why the Democrats on the committee have their own memo, which is supposed to get released, perhaps with redactions that Trump may put in. But that the question of burning sources would go to the presumably to the underlying material in the FISA application itself, which the New York Times is trying to get released, because there is a question now, once you start releasing parts of this, about what really does deserve to be classified and kept secret. And there is a really interesting and larger conversation about overclassification in the government. It's impossible to know how these things fit together because we keep flying half blind in this whole conversation. But I do think that's part of it. Anyway.
Well, one other thing it's hard in these kinds of instances too, because I think that all the huge rambling thing I just gave is the most important way to look at this, but there is, and we've talked about it on this show, the FISA court has incredible power. And so it's a separate conversation, but you don't want the FISA court to be able to go unleash this kind of surveillance of an American citizen easily. Now, in this case, let's divorce this from the fact that Carter Page had been looked at before, and that we don't know.
He described himself as an informal advisor to the Kremlin.
Right. And we don't know, again, the full picture here, which is, again, why this memo is damaging. If your interest in life is to make sure that the FISA court has accurate information and that it isn't being spun by the FBI sleuths in order to go do something which we should be really nervous about, which is spying on Americans, you should care about that. But if you really cared about it, you would present all the evidence and not cook it by only releasing the partisan evidence, because now a conversation about that important thing has this incredibly partisan cast to it.
I think you guys make extremely compelling and smart points. I did think that Dahlia Lithwick made a really good argument in a piece she wrote for Slate, which is that for all its splodgy failure, for all the ways in which it is a mess and misleading and doesn't say that which its advocates say it says, the Nunes memo is a success if your goal is to sow doubt and confusion about the FBI, FISA, the judicial system, the surveillance state, to undermine institutions, to increase partisan disagreement. People, it didn't produce clarity. It simply left people more disillusioned and more angry than they were before. And the institutions are thus slightly, perhaps not even slightly, are eroded and damaged. And I don't think that Chris Wray or Rod Rosenstein is likely to be ousted because of the Nunes memo or to leave their job because of the Nunes memo. But I do think that the public trust in these institutions is lower than it was before because it chafes everything. There is now this confusion. And that's the tragedy of this controversy.
Right. And what surprised me when it finally came out was how relatively worthless it is for vindicating Trump, given the ways in which the intelligence community, the Justice Department, everyone was warning, please don't do this for all the reasons you just said.
It felt weird, like whether the flopping is the penalty, I guess, in soccer and in basketball for pretending you've been fouled when you haven't been. It felt like Democrats could have been charged with that. Recognizing the argument you've just made, David, that this is not a cost-free event, but the hue and cry beforehand was so overwhelming that this was going to, you know, undermine the entire. It just felt a little overdone when we saw the essentially what was poorly written, poorly argued, and weak on the evidence memo that finally came out.
But if you're worried about degrading the institutions and you also feel like you're trying to have the back of the people who are saying, don't do this, and you're worried about the precedent, yeah, right? I mean, the House Intelligence Committee had never done something like this before. And I think that was part of what the don't release faction was complaining about. Although, in the end, you're right about the what you just said.
It's a signaling exercise. Can we go back
to Mueller and Trump's interview?
What I was about to do, Emily. Let's go back to it. So to ask you some questions, Legal Eagle, does the president have to talk to Mueller if Mueller asks? Does being president get you some special exemption? If the president refuses to talk to Mueller, what is the recourse that Mueller has?
So, I mean, because we're talking about the president, we don't absolutely know the answer. But the existing precedent we have from the Nixon era suggests that, yes, Trump does have to talk to Mueller, that it will be legally dangerous as well as politically risky to try to duck the interview, that written questions are not a substitute for a spoken interview. So all of that said, why is John Dowd, one of Trump's lawyers?
Can I just interrupt and ask a question? I do not recall from Watergate that Nixon was ever interviewed under oath in person by a prosecutor. I mean, he turned over material. But
that's
he himself
right.
never the, submitted
the
to
Nixon
an interview.
The Nixon precedent comes from the tapes because they resisted turning over the tapes so vehemently. And then they had to turn over the tapes. So that's different from an interview. But it's Clinton who had to testify in the White House. But his answers were being sent to the grand jury to listen to. That was the kind of accommodation. And you could imagine Mueller's folks agreeing to that same accommodation with Trump. But to say written questions or we don't have to do this at all would seem to be receding from where we think the existing law is. And, you know, on the other hand, if Trump really refuses and Mueller and Trump then have to have a fight about this that goes to the Supreme Court, I'm sure that I would imagine that is not something Mueller's team will relish because it's ginning up this conflict before Mueller's team reports out, you know, does anything with its findings. And so I would say that's I can't imagine that Mueller wants that outcome. On the other hand, just letting Trump not talk to them if they have questions that they want answered just seems to me deeply mistaken for all the reasons I always feel about this, which is that the president can't be above the law.
A couple of things that strike me. One is that even if you had a president who was more associated with the truth as we experience it, you would
the facts as we have them.
The presidency is a job in which basically everybody helps you create an unreality, both by the way they sort of bubble wrap you in pleasant news, and also the way people rarely challenge you. So even if you had a truth bound president, this would be a tricky situation because you're just not used to a situation in which you can't shade things. I'm not saying you have to have shaded things as a president, but you have this unreality you live in. In this case, the special counsel has interviewed, under oath 22 White House officials, which means that he knows a great deal about what happen to the extent that people's memories aren't faulty and so forth. But I mean, people are...
Well, and he has lots of emails and other things too.
He has a picture and a picture that is missing one piece. And if the president doesn't provide that piece and tries to put his piece somewhere else, Mueller is very much likely to know it. So this is a dangerous territory. And I wonder what, Emily, you think in terms of just a lawyer thinking, gee, I don't want to send my client into that kind of a situation. But the other thing that I wonder about is, Emily, you mentioned both the legal and the political damage for the president if he decided not to testify. First of all, couldn't he just plead the Fifth? Isn't that an option open to him?
Yeah, he can say that this could incriminate me.
Right. But then that's a problem. Yeah. So then the second question is this, which is politically, he clearly is willing to do things that would lose him standing with people outside of his base. So if he's willing to, if he's not going to be pressured the way a traditional president would be by the public sanction that would come from turning down somebody like Mueller, who is approved of by both Republicans and Democrats, then it becomes a question of whether, if you're thinking this through in the way he might, whether the fight over pulling him in to testify, the court fight, allows him opportunities to undermine Mueller, undermine the judicial system, do something to essentially say the system is rigged, as he did both during the election, as he's done during these investigations, and repeatedly has shown that he's done even in his private court cases, whether it just, you know, because the alternative is actually testifying, which could be no fun at all.
So two thoughts. I mean, one is that, you know, Trump has said that he is eager to talk to Mueller. So that is going to make it a little hard for him to turn on a dime and say, no, I can't do this because the system is rigged, when in fact the system just consists of like sitting down and answering questions.
And just to interject, his lawyer on Face the Nation, when asked this question, said, absolutely, the president will testify.
That was Ty Cobb.
No, that was Jay Sekulow.
Yeah. Okay, different lawyer. Because Ty Cobb, another of the lawyers, still, it sounds like, wants him to testify. So there's that. I think the other thing is, you know, there's this idea that Trump is incapable of telling the truth in this kind of setting. And that's not true. I mean, when you go back and read his deposition in the case involving Tim O'Brien, and this is the lawsuit over Tim O'Brien's book and how much Trump was worth at the time, I mean, he admits that he's exaggerated. He has like a grasp of reality in that deposition. And so, you know, that suggests that when lawyers say to him, look, there's a cost to lying in this particular setting, you can't do it, that he can understand that the way any person can understand that. And then the question is, can he give truthful answers that don't create legal jeopardy for him in light of the picture and all the puzzle pieces we were just talking about? And that, of course, is why Mueller wants to talk to him.
But I just to end on this, because I think we've gone on long enough. But Emily, I do think the difference is that he's now had a year of the drug of the presidency. And I think when you're a private business person dealing with real dollars, and he was 20 years younger for most of those depositions, it does seem to me like he's a man whose mental capacity seems somewhat diminished. The presidency creates the sense of unreality. I'm not sure that he has the savvy and the brilliance to get through an interview with Robert Mueller without lying a lot. I just don't believe
well,
that.
Well, then tough. That's how it goes, right?
But that's why, if I were his lawyer,
John Dowd is.
Yeah, I would not let him anywhere near it. It wouldn't let him anywhere near it. It can't possibly be good. He should take it, you know, as far as he can, the way John described.
It's a game of chicken. I mean, first of all, I do think that it's going to be hard for him. I mean, whatever. Of course, he'll come out with all his usual bravado and make up some reason that he can't do it all of a sudden, and his base will march along, I guess. But that's going to be weird. And then the other thing is, if you lose that fight in front of the Supreme Court, that's not a good thing for your presidency, presumably.
If you're a lawyer, so what David, I know that we'll end this here because we don't.
David has moved on.
But as a lawyer, if I'm a lawyer, I'm looking at where your duties lie here. I mean, it seems to me that somebody's hired me. I'm going to tell them, A, don't talk, and let's fight this all the way through. Is there any point at which you have another duty to anything else?
No.
Yeah.
Not unless you think the person committed bodily injury to someone else. No.
Okay. So, Slate Plus members every week get an extra segment on the GabFest. And this week's is particularly juicy. We're going to talk about emotional support animals, pegged to the wonderful story of the peacock that was turned away, the emotional support peacock that was turned away by an airline this week. And David Leonhardt is going to come and talk to us after about his brilliant column about emotional support animals. Are emotional support animals a sympathetic policy that reduces human suffering and creates human-animal comradeship at a high level? Or are they a toxic scam to get people's stupid dogs onto airplanes where they don't belong? We will discuss that. Go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member of Slate Plus.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th only on Hulu.
The stock market has been up, up, up. Then last Friday, it was down. And then Monday, it was down, down, down a lot. The largest drop in history in terms of raw points, although certainly not in percentage terms. Earlier this week, it bounced back up. But it's still, as we're taping, down about 4% from its record high of about a week ago. These gyrations have prompted anxiety and outpourings of stress among some this week. The stock market has been so boring for so long. It's just been positive and gently jumping upwards every week. So there's liberal glee at the fact that a president who has bragged so incessantly about the Dow being humbled by it, having it crater briefly. And then there's just questions about whether the stock market's drop signals anything about the larger economy. To discuss the market's drunken walk, we have our favorite economics writer, the New York Times columnist, David Leonhardt. David, welcome back to the GabFest.
Thanks for the nice words.
So one of the puzzling things for civilians like me about the mishigas around the market this week, David, was the notion was that it was caused, that the drop was caused by a rise in American hourly wages, that American workers were earning more and doing better, and that caused the stock market to retreat. So can you, first of all, just walk us through the logic of why that might be the case? And why the stock market briefly sort of fluttered?
I'll answer the second one first, if that's okay, because I think it's important for people who are trying to follow the news of the stock market to know that much of what's being said about it, you can just safely ignore. Because
including this segment?
No, I could
go get a coffee now.
This is going to be the segment that helps you understand it and then lets you ignore other commentary in the future. Right. When you read a newspaper or website story, or you hear people on TV kind of pronouncing why the market did what it did on a given day, they are usually guessing. And so there isn't some secret place you can go and see why stocks fell. This involves psychology, and it's really hard to know. In fact, on most days, it's impossible to know why the market did what it did. But journalists have to try to sound like they know what they're talking about, so they often come up with what is the most plausible reason, and it might or might not be correct. So we don't know whether this increase in wages caused the market to drop. Maybe it did. Maybe it didn't. Maybe people finally got freaked out about Donald Trump. Who knows? And I think that's just really important for everyone to keep in mind when they're hearing commentary. So if, in fact, the rise in wages is the reason the market fell, why would that be? That would be because few things scare investors quite the way inflation scares investors. Because if inflation starts to take off, it basically over time makes the value of their investment worth less. If you think about the bad inflation of the 1970s, the stock market did terribly during that period. And so rising wages seems like it might be a sign that inflation is going to take off. I'm very skeptical of that because for almost a decade now, consistently, people have been overly worried about inflation. Inflation is still lower than the Federal Reserve would like to see it. And so seeing 1 month of decent wage growth, I think, is fairly unlikely to lead inflation to take off. But if, in fact, that's what caused the market to fall, that's what was going through people's heads.
David, may I? Two questions. One, is there another piece to the narrative of wages, inflation? And is the third piece or another piece that the Fed, in response to the fears about inflation, then raises rates and that hurts corporate earnings? A, that's the first question.
And the second one scares investors.
And the second question is on the hokum that you were talking about so accurately beforehand. It reminds me a lot of the way people talk about politics.
Yes.
And how voters are behaving and responding. And so, A, do you buy that analogy? It sounds like you do. And B, isn't it even more insane now because there are all of these financial instruments that on any given day can create a kind of automated behavior in response to all kinds of indices that we don't have any understanding of. And therefore, there's the normal level of hokum. But now, because there's so many other kinds of things that can make the market move, there's an even greater chance that you're going to be wrong in assigning purpose to its movements.
Yes and yes. John, you're like a secret economics correspondent. So
God, love you.
Yes, inflation is basically this disease, and it's bad in its own way, right? But then also, the Federal Reserve tries to cure it. And it tries to cure it by raising interest rates, just like you said, and the side effect of that can be a recession, which is also really bad for stocks because people make less money. Absolutely. On the second question, I agree. I mean, it reminds me, this is not a perfect analogy, but no analogy is. It reminds me of those polling questions when pollsters say, what issue are you most concerned about? And then they pretend that that is why people voted the way they did. Mm-hmm. Whereas, in fact, most of the time, John, correct me if I'm wrong here, people make a decision based on a series of reasons that we can't always know. And then they answer the question about what their most important issue was based on who they decided to vote for.
Totally, totally. And as somebody who used to treat the polls as gospel in every possible way, I recognize...
You've had a conversion experience? You no longer
do? I still think they're useful for what I essentially originally thought they were useful, which is to give us inferences and ideas about where people's heads are. And then, as David quite rightly points out, that sometimes an opinion is a proxy for another emotion. So don't think it's necessarily answering the question specifically in front of them, but that it does give us clues about other ways they might have been thinking. So I'm not saying I've given up on them totally. I'm just saying that they're not gospel in the same way that we shouldn't think that, things like wage increases are the gospel in terms of why the market moved.
So how much do we have to care about all of this to ask a dumb question? I mean, we keep being told over and over again, the stock market is not the economy. So are we giving inordinate attention to this to start with? And also, is there any point in railing against the irritation of having finally workers get a raise be the reason that the market drops, or is that just like silly because those forces are responding to this fear of rising inflation, and to the sort of moral value I'm ascribing to this is beside the point.
Wait, before you answer that, David, can I just jump on Emily's question and add on to it, which is the market
David
is up.
David needs to be keeping a list of our questions. No,
it's the same question. I just want to make your question even stronger. The stock market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, is up fourfold since March of 2009. The economy is not four times stronger, greater than it was. So,
right.
So there's no sense is the growth of that stock index reflected in the actual prosperity of the nation overall. Number one. Number two, I have always found it totally weird that a minute of my newscast every day is devoted to telling me the string of numbers, which
yes.
mostly aren't changing very much. But it's occupying mental space in a way that, like, it shouldn't. It's just like, it's just a tax on me. It's a 1 minute tax on me every day. And why is that? Shouldn't we just be allowed to ignore it, as Emily says?
Well, and the full extreme version of that is when they give you the decimal places on these indices that you don't even know what they mean if they kept the decimals out.
Why didn't they round it?
So, Emily, you asked, should we care? And I think the answer is yes, we should care about what the market does, but we shouldn't always root for it to go up. And I think that is the mistake that people sometimes make. So we should care because the market has all kinds of big effects on society. It often is a leading indicator of what the economy is doing. It can be a cause of economic problems. I mean, if you were simply looking at economic growth in the year 2000, you would have thought the American economy was doing fantastically. But if you were to look at the market, you wouldn't have thought it was doing so well. And I actually think that it started to notice a turn. And that's one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons why Al Gore didn't do better in the 2000 election, because he was running, yes, while the economy was strong, it was also clearly weakening. And so the stock market's direction matters in all kinds of ways that we should care about. But we shouldn't simply, as so much media commentary assumes, we shouldn't simply root for it to go higher and higher and higher for a whole bunch of reasons. One, David, as you were saying, it's mostly benefiting very affluent people. There's even this funny dynamic in which if you're 25 years old, maybe you should root for the stock market to go down.
And then up.
And if it goes up too much up now, you basically have to buy in expensively. Right. And so I would say if you're 25 years old, even if you're not hate rooting against the market because you don't like Donald Trump, you really should not be rooting for the market to go up that much because you are going to have many years of buying at the current price and you'd rather buy cheap and then have it go up later.
May I ask a question about interest rates and the Fed and the deficit and debt? So we have seen now, especially with the budget bill, that it appears to be in agreement, plus the tax bill, a significant increase in our fiscal or a significant change in our fiscal picture with no sign really that there's going to be any effort to deal with the underlying drivers of those numbers. Does that matter? Will that matter to inflation? Will that matter to the overall health of the economy? I asked that this week because we have a budget deal that's going to add $500 billion. And I guess borrowing is at about $1 trillion this year, which is up considerably from last year.
And when is it going to matter, right? Because if surely eventually will matter.
Yes, eventually it will matter. This is, I think that most of us who think about economics and write about economics have been too worried about the deficit over the last decade or so, 15 years. And I would include myself in that. I would offer a mea culpa of having worried too much about the deficit.
I feel like somewhere the Obama people are like having a long stiff drink as they listen to everyone's mea culpas on this point.
Yeah. And look, to their credit, a couple of them screamed at me. Maybe not scream is an exaggeration, but you know, a lot of them were unhappy with how much people like us paid attention to the deficit. Now, there is a real long-term problem with the deficit, and it is serious, right? The Medicare problem is a really serious problem, and the kind of short-term deficits that we had early on in the Obama administration were frightening. But it seems, to answer John's question, that all of the signs are that we have a manageable deficit now. Right. If we did not, the markets would be reacting with alarm to the increase in the deficit that this administration and Congress are now putting in place. And so it looks like our economy is able to handle the deficits quite well. That doesn't mean this is a good tax bill, right? Because I would argue there are many other priorities besides tax cuts for affluent people that should take precedence. But it does mean that there is some room in the short and medium term to increase the deficit without creating some kind of problem in the markets. We saw that in the Obama administration, interest rates stayed low, and now we're seeing it in the Trump administration. The long-term problem doesn't go away, which is really a Medicare problem. We have made promises to people that are vastly greater than the amount of money we have to pay for it. We really are going to have to fix that. That doesn't just go away. But it looks like short and medium term, the deficit, as best as we can tell, is manageable.
I saw a surprising, amazing fact this week, which I was shocked to learn, which is that we've reached the point where Social Security is paying out more than it's taking in. There's no more. We are no longer accumulating in the Social Security Trust Fund. We are now paying it down.
Yep. Social Security is a problem too. It's just the scale of it is much smaller than Medicare, and relatively simple fixes could probably deal with
it. So does that answer mean that we shouldn't be too concerned about the $500 billion bump that John was talking about in the budget deal if it passes the House as well as the Senate?
I guess I would think of it as a cost-benefit thing. And to me, the cost of that size increase in the deficit is not enormous. But the benefit of much of the kind of stuff that they're putting in the deal, I also think is really small. And so that doesn't mean it's a good deal. If they were using this money to fix our infrastructure give payroll tax cuts to middle class and lower class people, or invest a lot of money in alternative energy, I would be all in favor of it. But saying that it has a low cost, it also has a really low benefit. And so I still don't love the deal.
That's a very, very well put.
And are you talking now about the military spending part or the social programs part or both?
Kind of all of it.
Having low benefit.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, the social program stuff, I think, has some benefits, some significant benefits. You know, I think CHIP, for example, the Children's Health Insurance Program, is a very important program. I'm not suggesting moving away from that. I just wouldn't want to make the leap to the kind of deficit increases that they're piling on when you combine the tax cut with the budget deal. Those look like they're manageable. I wouldn't then want to make the leap to, and thus, these are some pretty good bills.
Two things. The market to watch in terms of when the debt does start to affect us is stock market, bond market, or both? That's the first question. The second one is, wasn't there also a second part of the deficit as a problem theory that was that we covered and wrote about and people talked about over the last 15 years or so, which was the economic effect. But then there was a belief that conservative voters in particular would punish lawmakers for running up those numbers and not doing what was necessary. And what we've seen certainly with respect to this budget and the tax bill and the lawmakers in this case, all of them Republicans because they're running Congress right now, that those fears that anybody would be punished were non-existent.
That's right.
Well, roughly non-existent.
Exaggerated, right. I think there's strong evidence that voters left, center, and right are relatively unconcerned about the deficit, and that there's this, Matt Iglesias coined this term, the pundit fallacy. I'm sure you're all familiar with it, in which people confuse their policy wishes with what good political advice is. And I think we've seen that on the deficit, which is tons of kind of left center and right center people in Washington who want the deficit to be lower said it's really important politically, but it doesn't appear to be. I would say follow the bond market first for the deficit and the stock market second.
The other thing, though, about the deficit is that it was a signaling item, as we were talking about earlier, about the difference between what people think about an issue and then what it really means for them. So for a long time, for conservatives, it was a signaling and it was a way to send a whole bunch of ideas to voters about your views about the Obama administration or about just Washington in general.
And a reason to shrink the size of the government.
Yeah. What is the liberal equivalent to this hypocrisy on the right? It is this particular hypocrisy is maddening, the way that conservatives just could not stop talking about the stupid deficit for 10 years. And then the minute they got to do the spending, they reversed field entirely. What is the liberal equivalent? Like, what is the thing that liberals...
Being willing to shut down... Oh, I was going to say being willing to shut down the government was starting to look like that a few weeks ago. Like, you trot out the quotes about how terrible and damaging. I don't think that's necessarily equal in weight.
Is it free trade or protectionism?
I was going to say, I think, Emily, you're right about the hypocrisy there, though it was kind of, that was kind of one-shot hypocrisy.
Yeah.
I mean, in this case, having covered conservative politics since the early 90s, the number of voters I've talked to and the number of candidates I listen to talk about the overwhelming stop all the presses, don't do anything else if we don't lower the debt and deficit was, I mean, I don't think I've ever heard about anything else more in my entire career. And it's not that, you know, and then you could have a debate about whether you believe the growth numbers of the current tax bill, but that's not even the point. It's that only Bob Corker was the one like waving the tiny little deficit flag when the debate was going on, that it was almost entirely absent from the debate, and the disconnect between the tonnage of words spent and then the puny little shriveled sentences was what was so striking. And is your question, David, about could it include values issues or just stuff?
It could include anything. I'm just struck at how enormous the shift is on the right, and totally unsurprising. I mean, we all knew it was going to happen. I mean, nobody wants to be the cutter when they can spend money.
But
I just wonder if there is a liberal equivalent. And I'm sure there is. I just can't call it to mind.
And remember from Paul O'Neill's book that he attributed the quote to Dick Cheney during the early years of George W. Bush, where he was trying to talk to Cheney about the deficit. And I suppose I can't remember whether it was the first Bush tax cut. And basically, Cheney said Reagan proved that deficits don't matter.
Right.
And Cheney was right.
Right.
I mean, he meant politically speaking.
Right. One last question for Emily or David or John. So the president has linked arms with the Dow. He's been dancing, waltzing at Mar-a-Lago with the Dow, taking credit for the growth of that stock market index. There's, of course, a huge amount of schadenfreude on the left now that it's hiccuped. Do you think he's actually going to pay a price for having been so attached to it, or it doesn't really matter because he'll just distance himself? He'll pick something else to dance with.
I've changed my mind a little bit about this over the last week, and I don't think his bragging about the stock market matters. because I think whether or not he brags about it, he'll get credit essentially if it's doing well. And whether or not he had bragged about it, he'll get punished if it's doing badly. And maybe on the margins, it'll be a little worse because he bragged about it. But the fact is that voters are going to blame the president for the condition of the economy, whether or not he took credit for it himself earlier on. We've seen that again and again and again. And so maybe it matters on the margin, but I don't think it matters much.
I think also the disconnect we're learning about in this presidency is between the people's feelings about the economy and the people's feelings about this president. So it may not, it may be that people have their feelings about him completely about non-economic matters. I also felt like the Schadenfreude that you described, David, really bled into, and maybe I'm confusing Twitter versus coverage, but it felt like a lot of people who, for some number of months, were saying the president has nothing to do with the strength of the stock market, and he shouldn't do that. We're suddenly pointing out this inconsistency in a way that I felt was really transparent for people who are otherwise supposed to be analysts and not rooting.
So before we end, David, you and I are sitting next to each other, and you have a multicolored chart next to you, and we won't be able to display this to you, listeners, because you're listening, but. Paint a picture.
I will. I realize that charts are not the most effective form of podcast information. So I think the biggest reason to be concerned about the stock market is that it is extremely expensive right now. And my chart comes from Robert Shiller, the Nobel laureate economist, who has constructed a measure of the price-earnings ratio that I think many people think is the best one because it is a long-term price-earnings ratio. It doesn't look at a company's earnings over the last few months, as many do. It looks at them over the last 10 years. And by that measure, what this chart shows is that the price-earnings ratio of the stock market is now 33. And there have been vanishingly few times in history when it has been so high. In fact, there have been two. 1929, a year that I assume you all will recognize, and right before the market collapsed in 2000, which I mentioned before. That does not mean the market is going to collapse this time, but it is. I do think the market has less room for error because people are paying a real premium to get a cut of corporate America's earnings.
I love the 1981 where you have that incredible reversal where it's everything is so cheap.
Well, so that
why didn't we buy stock? Why didn't I buy stock in 1981?
And that relates to the point we made earlier. The younger people in their 20s should root for the market to go down. Think of all those people who were able to spend the entire 80s buying the stock market when it was super cheap. They have much nicer retirements than a lot of millennials may have.
David Leonhardt, thank you for joining us. You'll be back for Slate Plus.
Thank you.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Washington has been transfixed this week or in the middle part of this week by the strange and troubling story of Rob Porter, a White House official who I certainly had not heard of until Wednesday morning. But Porter is a close aide to Chief of Staff John Kelly. He's the staff secretary to the president, means he controls the flow of paper to the president. And it came out in a series of articles. I'm not sure who broke it.
Daily Mail, I think.
Daily Mail in England.
The Intercept
and
also.
Blogging. Yeah. I mean, anonymous. One of them was anonymous
that,
blogging.
That anyway. His two ex-wives, he's very young to have two ex-wives, but his two ex-wives both.
I don't think you want to stay married to this person for very long.
Accused him of abuse, of spousal abuse. One of those ex-wives, his first ex-wife, then distributed a picture of her with a black eye that she says he gave her. And the other one described in an anonymous blog post, but it was then traced back to her, his abuse, his physical pushing of her and also breaking windows with a fist and just an extremely volcanic and volatile temper. It also came out in the course of people learning about the scandal that the White House has known about Porter's history of domestic abuse for months and didn't do anything about it. They knew also that he hadn't gotten an FBI security clearance possibly because of this. And
the wives had told the FBI.
The wives had told the FBI all about this, and yet had kept him on. He retained strong support from Kelly, from Orrin Hatch, who was his rabbi, one of his rabbis in his career. And only once this photograph of his first wife with a black eye was released did Porter then resign from the White House while strongly denying the allegations. And also, in one further twist, because there is never not a further twist when it comes to the Trump administration, it turns out that Porter had been dating Hope Hicks, the White House, whatever her title is, communications director.
Communications director.
So, man, I don't even know where to start. John, just
can
say
I add
something.
Just one other? Well, that's always there's a certainty that's always going to happen. One thing also that just the fact pattern here is that he was also at one point, according to published reports, dating, and CBS confirmed this, dating a woman who reached out to one of the ex-wives and said, our relationship has become emotionally abusive. Was this your experience? And so there's kind of a third.
Was that during or before or after he was dating Hope Hicks?
This was before. Yeah. So one of the things that struck me about the original reaction and that bears repeating is it's not really the case, it doesn't seem to me, in human experience, that a number of different people who don't know each other suddenly all come together and open themselves up to the kind of scrutiny and abuse that the three women we're talking about here could have received and probably are receiving in some way as all a part of a carefully orchestrated plot. That just isn't the way it works. So for the initial reaction to be this is a vile smear, for that to have been true, you would have to have three independent people deciding to engage in a smear with all of these supporting details and willing to endure the pain and just life interruption that would cause, just presumably to undermine this poor fellow. This is in this narrative. So it's the more likely explanation in this case is probably that the events that they say happened, and so they should be taken seriously. And so the fact that the White House knew about these events, and they knew about them because of the FBI interviews that are required to get the clearance, what did they do? Did they look at them and say, this is very serious, let's get to the bottom of this? Chief of Staff Kelly said at first that he was a stand-up guy and then said, well, these new revelations are deeply troubling. Well, they weren't new revelations. And so this is a question for the chief of staff to answer. Were they new to him? What was new? Because they knew about this.
The embarrassing photograph was new. That's
well,
what's new.
I don't know if that's what he was talking about was new, though. But
can't we surmise that in fact he was forced to confront facts that he had essentially known all along?
But did it require the photo? I mean, what we want to know is what's the delta between what he knew as a result of the FBI interviews and what he now knows? And is it sufficiently new to claim, oh, well, if I'd only known? And so were they going through, just what kind of investigation were they going through? Or was the kind of clearance he had a kind of workaround because they knew this information and basically knew they couldn't get him an official clearance based on what was known in the FBI file, but they still wanted him because, and this is really important, he was a person with a lot of experience in Washington. He was in this crucial job and a job that was crucial to the White House as it exists now because the staff secretary creates order of information. And you'll remember all the reporting that was done before about the kind of information that would get to the president that would rile him up, that was incomplete, incorrect, or conspiratorial, and that getting charge of the information flow is crucial for any White House and particularly crucial for this White House. But if your job is to run things according to Hoyle, to have everything be ship shape, then was your handling of this information in ship shape the way you're trying to make the White House? And it doesn't appear that it was.
I can't really say how disgusted I am by the story. I mean, Rob Porter seems clearly to be someone who is a serial abuser, and that's awful. But I think actually what makes me feel the most unsettled is John Kelly calling him a man of true integrity and honor at a time when he clearly knew the substance of these allegations. He just was missing the embarrassing photo. I just don't know how to square that. I really don't. I mean, I feel the same way about Orrin Hatch. I understand that people can be professionally successful and compelling when they have horrifying private lives. But these men knew essentially what this what Porter was being accused of, and they chose to not just ignore it, but, you know, treat him with the highest dignity, give him the highest kind of compliments. That just makes me shudder.
I agree, although I do have a larger question, which is, I mean, this person clearly should not have been subjected to the praise and defense that he's been given by the White House. What is his status in the world? If you're somebody who's been accused of spousal abuse, there have been no criminal charges filed. Like, should he not have been able to have the job? Should he have been able to have can you not have any job? Can you just not have a job in the White House? I'm a little bit puzzled about how we should think about whether this person is fit to be a worker at all, or fit to be a worker in the White House, or he can't, you know, he needs to be in prison. I just don't know the answer.
Right. Listeners, don't mistake the question David's asking, which is a really interesting one.
Well, it's about proven, right? Someone who hasn't been convicted.
Right. And also,
or charged, yeah. Right? You're not
or charged.
Or charged.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And so I just don't want people to think like, oh, you're excusing what he did.
Yeah, no, I'm not
a million miles. It's a totally legit question, but I'm just the people who misheard it, which I have some experience with this. Just want to put a pin in that. It's a really legit and interesting question. I think one little piece of it that I would break off is you have two challenges with respect to a White House, three challenges. One is, you could imagine it was blackmail material or potentially blackmail material.
And that might have had to do with why he was denied a permanent security clearance.
That's right. So that's the one. The second is you should, if you were his boss, come to some conclusion about whether this behavior in his private life represents a certain volatility and whether that volatility can affect the actual job he's supposed to do. And then the third is this fellow inside the White House might end up dating somebody else who's in an important position in the White House. And if this is the way in which his relationships have evolved, and there's at least three instances in which they have, then you run into the kind of collateral effects you might have from a relationship with another top White House employee.
How about four? You don't want to send a message that this is tolerable behavior that you accept. And so, yes, there's a higher standard for getting a job in the White House than are you facing or have you been convicted of domestic violence? You know, if the women are telling credible stories that are distressing to the FBI in some way, isn't that a signal you should be paying attention to? And if you don't, then you're sending a message that you don't care about this. There are other overriding priorities for you. And I deeply don't understand how that fits with the military values, the kind of upright character that John Kelly is supposed to embody in some form or fashion. I mean, Kelly has done other things in the last few months that have suggested that he parts company with my understanding of those values. I don't mean to say this is it, but this really I found pretty shocking.
Yeah. So do you guys think there's going to be I laugh as I ask this question. Do you think there's going to be any political cost? They're gonna bear. Sorry, I just like after a year,
ditty,
after
right.
a year of like, this,
right?
Like, oh, they're gonna pay. This is really they're gonna pay a price for this, but they're not paying a price for the rampant corruption, the presidential tweeting. But anyway, they're gonna pay a price for this.
Well, I do wonder if there are women who voted for Trump on the margins who have been having some kind of like sick feeling in their stomach or prickle at the back of their neck for a variety of reasons over the last year, for whom this will be a piece of evidence that could be a kind of last straw, because it just suggests such an antediluvian approach to gender dynamics.
I think it's a who knows what will happen. But I think this does pose a set of questions for the chief of staff, who was, you know, has a life of has dedicated his life to the country and is known as a person who believes in, you know, order and discipline, who talked about norms in a way from the White House podium that showed his public attention to keeping those norms. So what did he do in this case? What did he know? And if he didn't know anything, how is that the case? Who did? Who ultimately received this information in these FBI reports? Did they sit Porter down and say, can you explain this? And did he give an explanation that was sufficient for them? it's just a window into the most orderly portion of the White House, and raises questions about just how orderly they are and how seriously they took this information. And so to the extent that we're operating here in a different part of the White House, this isn't really about the president at all. You know, what does that tell us?
I don't know. It's about the president. These are his men. These are his hires.
Fair point. I'm sorry. I meant he is not, so far in the drama and the narrative as we know it, he has not been brought on stage. I'm sorry. But your larger point is, of course, right. And as somebody who spent a lot of time trying to get the president to answer how Corey Lewandowski's handling of a female reporter reflected on his management. I mean, Lewandowski was working for him, so what did he do?
Yes,
I think
similar set of questions.
Oh my God, there's so many domestic abusers. The labor secretary, right, was pulled.
Yes.
And then Bannon was accused.
Yeah.
God.
Well, I mean, this isn't really all that surprising.
All right, let's leave it there.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When John Dickerson, when you were having yourself a little nip of post-show brandy and chattering with your CBS This Morning co-host, what are you going to chatter to them about?
Well, I guess two things. One is quickly is the death of John Perry Barlow, who was both a Grateful Dead lyricist, but also an internet pioneer and thinker about freedom on the internet and what that should mean and what it and just sort of an early thinker about the internet and open internet culture. But he also wrote a wonderful list when he turned 30 called Principles of Adult Behavior, and I encourage everybody to go look at it. I am a huge fan of, I'm a huge fan of the whole thing. And also be careful, because there are different lists out there, and you want the one, I think it's 30 or so of them, but you want the most extensive list. You don't want the shortened list.
Let's make sure we post that somewhere, post a link to it.
Yeah. Okay. We will definitely post a link to it. In fact, I've sent it out on Twitter, which is, usually I don't, quote my own Twitter stream, because I think that's a little weird, but there is and I should note that the person who reminded me of this is a longtime listener, Cyrus. I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce your last, is it Farivar? Does that seem right?
Cyrus is such a great listener. He's covering the Uber trial right now, I note, and from his Twitter feed.
He's a wonderful listener, but actually, in this number 20, there are 25. So maybe what I was claiming was a shortened list wasn't. So there are 25 of them. I'm a huge fan of number 20 and number one. Number one, be patient no matter what. Number 20, understand humility. But there are they're really great. Anyway, that's John Perry Barlow. The other is a piece in the Wall Street Journal about jet lag and how Olympic skiers are courting jet lag, because it is such a mental freak show when you're hurtling down a ski jump that, you know, it's a crazy thing to do, even if you're highly skilled at doing it, that there are some that believe, and to give you some sense of the mental strain of it, here is one former ski jumper, Jeff Hastings, who says, mentally, it feels like suicide. The closer you come to committing suicide without committing suicide, the better you're going to be.
So they go around trying to get jet lag as a way of preparing themselves?
Well, the theory is, arrive with jet lag and you'll be a little mentally fuddled. So you'll just, muscle memory will take over.
Oh,
and
God.
You won't, you know, and the normal rule with jet lag is you wait one day to acclimate for every hour time zone that you cross. And I think in this case, the time zone is 13 hours or 14 hours.
So they're
hours?
Like, all right, let's go.
Yeah, so Pyeongchang is 14 hours. So anyway, the idea about these ski jumpers is encourage and court and be jet lagged.
Now I really don't want to be a ski jumper. Yeah. I mean, before I was thinking about it. Now
sure.
I really don't want to do it.
Well, you know, once you're stuck combating that empty nest syndrome, you might rethink about it.
Emily, what's your chatter? I think you have a real chatter today.
I am following with enormous interest the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's order to redistrict Pennsylvania, the state of Pennsylvania's congressional districts. This is a delegation that currently heavily favors Republicans. It's 5-13, even though Democrats generally win a little more than half, or at least last time, of all the congressional votes cast in the state. And there is, it's so interesting what's happening. So the Pennsylvania Supreme Court relied solely on the Pennsylvania Constitution in issuing this first order, now opinion, the idea that the Constitution in the state provides for honest and clear elections, and that that has been violated by extreme partisan gerrymandering. There's really no question by a variety of measures that the gerrymandering in Pennsylvania is extreme. And the Supreme Court this week, the U.S. Supreme Court, decided to stay out of this case. So even though the U.S. Supreme Court has Maryland and Wisconsin and North Carolina gerrymanders, congressional and state legislative, that it is dealing with, because the Pennsylvania case doesn't have the federal constitution in it, it's on a separate track. And so what's going to be super interesting to watch quite quickly is what happens with actually drawing this new map. The court told the Republican-controlled legislature to redraw really fast, deadline like on Friday, this Friday, probably by the time people are listening, for a new map. The legislature is furious about all of this, has threatened to impeach the five Pennsylvania Supreme Court justices who made this order, says that the court is usurping the legislature's powers. Governor Wolf, who's a Democrat, is the one who has to sign off on the legislator's map. If that doesn't happen, the court has already hired a special master who would get started. And there are primaries coming up in 3 months that are implicated in all of this. And then, of course, the 2018 election. So I mean, it's just going to be so interesting. And this question of, like, how do you redraw the map, which I haven't read the whole 139-page Pennsylvania Supreme Court opinion, which was just issued Wednesday. It sounds like they essentially are telling the map makers to abide by relatively traditional principles, which is you respect existing lines and incumbencies to the extent that you can without having extreme gerrymanders. And you also keep cities together and what we call communities of interest, which is a more nebulous concept. But it's just not clear how much of a change they're asking from the legislature. And so, of course, we're going to have this two parts. There's two elements to the fight in the next stages. One is the map, and will the governor accept it, and will the court accept it? And then the second is this question about separation of powers and how far the court went, and should they in particular have given the legislature more time to take their own crack? Anyway, I've gone on at way too much length about all of this, but it's really interesting to watch.
Well, it does seem the gerrymandering has graduated from being an obscure, slightly comical issue to being a progressive obsession. I mean, we also had the news this week that Eric Holder, the former attorney general, is starting this group that is going to fund efforts to try to prevent states from being excessively gerrymandered against Democrats by going after things like secretaries of state offices in Nevada and things like that. And so it's, so there's this recognition among Democrats who've just been way behind this, that getting more control over state offices is important, both because it gives you, you know, local control over state governments and things like that, but also because they're getting so battered on these redistricting issues.
Right. I mean, we should say the problem of racial gerrymandering has been one that has had a variety of political shapes for many years, because there's a whole recognized area of jurisprudence. The reason partisan gerrymandering is a new obsession is that the Supreme Court signaled when it took these Wisconsin and now Maryland cases that they might actually allow someone to strike down a map on the basis of partisan gerrymandering, which the Supreme Court has never agreed to that before. So that's why the door is open. And I think if you take a step back from this, what really is at stake is the lack of competitive races in the country and this question of polarization and the health of our democracy when so many congressional seats and state legislative seats are essentially just like handed to the person who is the has the R or the D, depending on how the district is drawn. I mean, that just is proving so troubling as a general phenomenon. And then if you're worrying about that, then the question is, how do we address it? And are court-based remedies the way to go? That's what we're seeing here. Or should states be creating nonpartisan commissions to draw lines instead, which is what the voters have voted for in states like Arizona? So this isn't the only remedy if this is an issue that concerns you.
One final point about this, actually, which is not mine. I read it somewhere, but I can't remember where. An interesting thing about partisanly gerrymandered states in wave elections is that a gerrymander can be catastrophic for the party that drew it.
That's right.
If you make districts where you've given huge majorities to Democrats in safe districts for Democrats, the few safe districts for Democrats, and then you give yourself narrow majorities in lots of other districts and many more districts in order to, so you give yourself a sort of a 60% majority in 13 districts and give Democrats 80% majority in their districts. If there's a wave which is going to get you, which is going against you, you can lose all those those gerrymandered seats because you have created no really safe districts for yourself while doing that.
Right. And in Pennsylvania, we already had Democrats excited about races based on resignations and the polls about voters' preferences in 2018. So, and I guess the last thing I'll say about Pennsylvania is because most Democratic voters are concentrated in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, this new map is very unlikely to create, you know, some wild swing where Democrats suddenly have 13 of 18 seats. The question is much more, you know, marginal about competitive races in a few more districts, like 4 or 5 or 3, than it is like transforming the legislative map in Pennsylvania.
All right. My chatter, two interrelated chatters. One, I just urge anybody who's interested in anything in humanity to read David Grand.
Okay.
Grand's New Yorker story this week.
Oh, the Antarctica story. I haven't gotten to that.
I read that.
It's called The White Darkness. It's a story about Henry Worsley, a British Arctic explorer who undertook the most incredible journey, a solo crossing of the Antarctic continent recently. It is about the misery of Arctic exploration, of course. It's about endurance. It's about manliness and courage and leadership and love. It's an incredible story. It's almost novella length. It's very long. I hope it's the basis of David's next book, but it's just very much worth your time. And relatedly, there is a series of gruesome stories this week about the permafrost of our cold parts of the world, including the Antarctic, but mostly, I guess, the Northern Arctic, which it turns out the permafrost contains most of the mercury that the planet has. And the permafrost at the moment holds all that mercury in. And as the permafrost melts, as it is expected to do with climate change and global warming, that mercury is going to be released with potentially really unpleasant consequences for us and our descendants in terms of brain development and other nasty side effects.
Mercury of all things. Yes. That's upsetting.
Yeah.
And also we should just note that in a recent interview, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency questioned whether maybe all of this global warming might not necessarily be beneficial somehow. So
that would be Scott Pruitt,
head
of the EPA.
Right. So this isn't just right. So, but it's not just, I guess, just those two things appearing in the same week or something.
That is our show for today. The Political Gabfest was produced today by Jason De Leon. Our researcher is Izzy Rode. Jocelyn is just on vacation. She'll be back. Don't worry, producer lovers, Jocelyn lovers. But not to say that Jason didn't do a great job and could come in any week and do a great job, Jason. Just to be clear.
And thanks, Jason, for Whistle Stop this week, too.
You can follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest. For Emily Bazelon, John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. And be sure to check out at slate.com/live our St. Louis live show on May 2nd. Hope to see you there, and we'll talk to you next week.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.